Hello and welcome to Shocked and Applaud. You're here with Lydia Malcolm and Naomi McQuaid, and we're about to talk about the movie Tusk.
Should we tell them which one of us is Naomi and which one is Lydia, or should we just leave them guessing?
We leave them guessing, but
yeah.
But if you know me, I'm Naomi.
If you know me, I would be Lydia then, just by process of elimination.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So, 2014's Tusk, written and directed by Kevin Smith. I think we could classify this as a fine film.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's well put together. It's well edited. It's well written, well acted, well directed.
But I still don't know how I feel about it. Not really.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe that's the beauty of the film. It leaves you guessing about a lot of stuff.
Okay. So to intro it, it was introduced on the Smodcast with Kevin Smith,
mm-hmm.
and I had not listened to it.
Me neither. You know, but you had mentioned earlier, before recording, by the way, that you like the idea of taking a film and taking it as its own, no matter what external forces. So even though this came from the Smodcast, it still should be a film that we today are looking at on its own.
Yeah, most artistic pieces should be able to be taken out of context as a whole entity instead of needing to have everything that preceded it and the reception afterwards. I mean, I came away a little different, I think, and that gives it validation as an artistic piece all on its own.
Right. So, just for some background, the first time I saw this movie was in the theaters in 2014. And then we rewatched it again today, just like literally a few minutes ago, finished it. Naomi, what's your background in Tusk?
I must have watched it. I watched it at home shortly after its release. I don't remember the ending from when I first initially watched it. And then I watched it yesterday and I watched it again today because I wanted to have like a chance to take down the story. And then today I wanted to just ingest it as a consumer. And I feel like I successfully did that because it can be taken a lot of ways. I think what drew me to watch it initially, uninitiated, was I like almost anything that I've seen Kevin Smith do. And I like horror and I like absurdity in my art. And so when I saw, you know, this is a movie about a guy who's being turned into a walrus, I was like, that seems right up my alley. Like, the banter will probably be good because of Smith, and the plot is just crazy enough that I'm going to eat it up.
Yeah, I think what drew me to the movie, to go see it, was the fact that I'm not really into horror. So any horror movie that that looks more like a psychological thriller, I'm more down for it. But I was kind of expecting that there would be a gore element here. I was not expecting the full amount of gore, which is not to say it's like blood everywhere. It's a different kind of gory.
Yeah, it's definitely not like an Evil Dead sort of feel, like
right.
Like optimum Raimi gore. It was definitely they held back, I mm-hmm. think, in a lot of ways, considering that the body count is 23.
Right. Technically 24. Because you got the 23 victims,
and then okay.
Yeah, see, no, we're not spoiling anything by doing it that way. Oh, what was I going to say? But what kind of drew me in was just, you know, the fact that it was going to be a horror movie, and it was going to be, you know, that absurdity is just.
I mean, where else have you seen that? That
no.
I mean, like, the transformation from one creature to another has been a trope in horror films forever. And so, but to be the majestic aquatic mammal that is a walrus has not been addressed. It's always been something much more land carnivorous predator. And although walruses are predators, you're talking about like a 2-ton beast that, you know, mostly just gains a harem and then eats a bunch of fish.
Well, walrus conservationists are so happy that you called it a majestic animal.
Oh, what do they call it? I took a class. They're called megafauna. Megafauna. Anything large that is dominant and glorious, like a whale or an elephant, is a megafauna.
Or a walrus.
Definitely, I think, not mm-hmm. excluding a walrus.
Okay, so we talked a little bit about our background with the movie. We talked about what drew us. Maybe now is the perfect time to talk about a synopsis.
Yes. So, opening scene. characters Wallace and Teddy laughing over a video, a viral video, that they're reviewing on their podcast. not unlike maybe a throwback to Kevin Smith's podcast or several other podcasts that kind of cash in on making fun of cultural icons, not unlike their Kill Bill Kid, which is obviously an offtake of the Star Wars Kid from good knows when that came out, because that's one of the very first Butt Roll videos.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, can I just say, they're reviewing a video on a podcast, and it just drives me crazy because they play this video, and I'm imagining myself in the car listening to a podcast where it's like, vroom, 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 vroom. Okay, except that's Star Wars Kid, but like it's the Kill Bill Kid, so he's got a katana, and he's swinging around, and I'm like,
how would you be able to watch it? How are they going to convey that to you?
There's no play-by-play. They're just laughing at it.
Yeah.
And then the movie shows the video, which has no dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm instantly like, come on, guys.
It's a horror movie. They have to be jackasses. So that way, when bad stuff happens, we don't feel bad about the fact that... Yeah.
You need to have a fallible character. Like, if I don't want to, I don't think the majority of audiences want to see a character of, like, upright moral astutitude, which is the first made-up word of the podcast. I don't want to see someone who I feel is morally upright get outed out of context or without any kind of plot build. So, interesting side note, things I know about the Star Wars Kid, dude's a lawyer now. He stands up for people who get... maligned on the internet.
Because he didn't actually enjoy his fame.
No, he was seriously abused.
Yeah. And I know is that he just did not like all of the attention that came from that one video. I don't know too much about it. Do you know anything that you'd like to say other than the fact that he's a fancy lawyer?
He's apparently very successful, and I think that while he will discuss it, he is not necessarily inclined to, I mean, even from the get-go, cash in on that, because it wasn't a fame that he was entertaining. It was a fame that was thrust upon him, which is an interesting contradiction to the characters in this film, because that's all Wallace really wants. I mean, even more than the character of Teddy, he's just like, give me famous!
Mm-hmm. Which, at some point they talk about, like, isn't the next scene, after the podcast is when they go and meet Wallace's girlfriend, Allie?
Well, okay, so it cuts from, and my notes are not glorious. They're mostly me being like, oh, this happened next. Oh, this happened next.
We just need accurate.
Okay, well, accurate with air quotes is what I got for you. Wallace goes to, it cuts from, the viral video podcast.
Mm-hmm.
It skips the next episode of their podcast, and it has him in Canada, and that's when he finds out that the guy kills himself. Okay, so on IMDb it says that he accidentally kills himself.
Okay.
I don't know. The movie doesn't really go into it. I think he might have mentioned it at the bar that he killed himself, but...
Yeah, if it's an accident, if he didn't mean to do it intentionally...
I mean, he accidentally sliced his entire leg off with some pretty epic CGI, so...
Yeah. Should we talk about that CGI? Because I was pretty, I mean, for that being in the opening credits, which is pretty much the first scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear some people say, I heard one YouTuber say that looking at the opening scene can be a good way to gauge how the rest of the movie is going to be. So the fact that you have this kind of like intense moment in the very opening scene, thank you, Kevin Smith, for giving us that. Because that pretty much gives us an idea of how the rest of the movie is going to be.
You're going to get blood when you don't expect it.
Correct.
And there's going to be a certain amount of violence that you should just be acclimated to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he gets to Canada, calls Teddy, says, you know, there's no story, I gotta find something. Cue the first bathroom scene. I just gotta put it out there. Like, and I'm okay, because I believe that, I mean, it wasn't until Psycho that a toilet was first flushed on the American screen. So, you know, that people need to eliminate waste is very important. But this movie goes at least one more time than I would generally totally engage in a movie about. I'm saying there's three potty scenes. There are three scenes where you see people go potty.
The best thoughts come from when you're on the toilet. I mean, and these are important. These are important.
Every single toilet scene is integral to the plot,
mm-hmm.
but there are also three of them.
Yeah.
Okay.
this is the absurdity we're talking about. I mean, just one level of the absurdity.
It just leans into it pretty hard, and I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
But also, like, I ignored the first one, and the second one, I was like, huh. And then the third one, I'm like, double, huh. Okay. So, Wallace finds himself in the bathroom of the H Bar in,
Manitoba.
And, okay. It's ridiculous that the first thing that I found absurd about this movie was that a millennial would read a handbill that was in cursive. There's a couple different reasons why I find this absurd. It's a handbill, which they keep saying that word. It's just a written notice on a pin board in the bathroom over the toilet, which is unsanitary. I'll excuse it. But it's an entire page in cursive. And as a person who's had a student come up to them and be like, why did you send me a postcard in Spanish? I'm like, honey, I don't know Spanish. I did write it to you in cursive. I know that that guy never had that in school. He's not going to look at, he's going to go, TLDR, and move on to the thing that's like, boobies, boobies, boobies. Because his entire character is billed as this guy who is, like, he's always pushing for the step too far. And like, I'm an old-timey sailor, and I'd like to tell you my tales of the sea, is not exactly conducive to the rancidness that he is portraying himself to always be putting forth. Which will bring us to the old Wallace, new Wallace bullshit, but it is bullshit.
And, like, can we bring up the fact that the customs agent said sadness was made by the U.S. and were hung like moose, which is foreshadowing for the third movie? So is there going to be, like, moose in the third movie?
It's called Moose Jaw, so it could be really good. So the customs guy's name is Harley Morenstein, and he is the host of Epic Mealtime. And he's made a habit of making cameos in several movies. And he's always this very patriotic Canadian, which is fantastic. And I have watched that man eat more bacon than I believe I have ever eaten. As an American, like, patriotism is just off the charts for certain individuals, and the rest of us are like, yes, I will sew a Canadian flag to my backpack when I travel abroad, but
right.
But he's just like, I'm a Canadian, a boot, sorry, hockey, bacon, maple, beards.
You never tell a Canadian that you're not interested, that you don't follow hockey.
Exactly. His lines are spot on for who he is as I see him as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I could have used three scenes of him in this film, and less potty time. And I'm sorry I worked with children, but I'm going to say potty instead of toilet, taking a piss or whatever.
He could have come back as the detective that Johnny Depp played.
I would have taken it.
That would have been fun.
You know who they sourced to play whatever the guy's name? I forgot who to write down.
LaPointe.
They sourced Quentin Tarantino for that part. He thought he was going to go for Michael Park's part. And when he found out that was not the case, he backed out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The rabbit hole is deep on this one.
Which is interesting because let's just put a pin in Quentin Tarantino, because I actually made a note in the notes that I made today, and I noticed something. Yeah. I mean, your notes are a lot more in-depth than mine. Again.
You see this scribbled squill? I've just been thinking about this really hard for the past week.
But even still, like, the ones that I was looking at here, let's go through these. I really was taken away by Michael Park's acting, and just kind of, like, that's what stood out to me the most, is probably the acting. It's really on point. And I mean, it's like, even Justin Long, when he's at the dinner table with Michael Parks. I know I'm jumping ahead.
Yeah, yeah. That's really when the whole thing cracks open.
Yeah.
That's when my notes start getting real scribbly and real, like, like, I have to keep writing things down.
Yeah.
Because if I don't, this very important tacit of the most ridiculous movie is going to pass me by.
Right.
We've jumped backwards and forwards. So we've left the studio, we have gone to Canada, we have met Harley, so bathroom scene, TLDR, note, handbill, excuse me, mm-hmm. on the wall. He decides to call the number on the handbill, and he ends up in what is a, he meets the hoser girls, the yoga yeah. hoser girls, which are played by Kevin Smith's daughter and Johnny Depp's daughter, who I should probably name. So it's a Harley and Lily Rose,
mm-hmm.
And they play disinterested clerks who give give direction to Wallace's character about where he's going next. And he acts like a douchebag because mm-hmm. he's just set up over and over again as a douchebag.
Mm-hmm.
He talks over people. He's like always kind of schmoozing, but he's also just like, I'm rude and I don't care. And which totally just shrieks highlighter level colors in face of the beautiful muted plains of Canada.
He's such an American.
It was almost too much. And that might be the theme through all of my notes. It was almost too much. Like, but then they'd like, bring it back, and then somebody else would step forward with their own douchebaggery. Okay. So, Hoser Girls, if you haven't watched Yoga Hosers.
We should. Well, I should.
You could. I have. I don't know if I would again. I might again. For you, I might again. Okay. Okay, so he's calling the character now introduced, Howard Howell of the famed Handbill,
mm-hmm.
calling for people to come have free lodging in exchange for stories and chores.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's interesting that he was looking for someone to be a long-term lodger, but entertain somebody who's just like, I just want to come hear your stories. And then probably a string of expletives and sexually derisive comments.
Right. I mean, that makes sense. If he's going to go ahead and be using these people for a short term, he's probably looking for people who are homeless, who are looking for a room in exchange for that. I don't know if he was expecting someone it almost seems like because the police know about this. Again, Lydia, jumping ahead. Because the police know about it, it's almost like these people are still in contact with their loved ones. And so it's...
So he's like, who could love this guy? Let's bring him in.
Yeah, probably. I mean, he's obviously looking for people who are easy targets. This guy is definitely an easy target. He's a foreigner. Probably just by the way he was acting. I don't know. I mean, he may have just been looking for someone who was an easy mark, and seeing this guy may have just been the easy mark. But again, this is an absurd film. He could have had absolutely no logic.
Well, as a true crime fan, the escalation of serial killers, they tend to exponentially escalate. So we find out later on that he hasn't had contact with the police directly in 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So
obviously he's doing something right to not get caught.
Yeah. Or maybe Canadian cops aren't that great at their jobs.
Sick burn.
So he leaves. So Wallace leaves these chicks at the counter with a sour taste in their mouth because mm-hmm. he's a douchebag. But they make fun of him, and it was funny.
Yeah.
They make fun of his terrible mustache with little straight combs, which is mm-hmm. great. And then we cut to Wallace arriving at the estate. He has to walk through some dark woods a la friggin' Rocky Horror Picture Show, and it's too dark. Apparently my screen was down too low, but just you see a glimmer of his forehead as he wanders past the mm-hmm. Pippi Hills sign.
Oh, and that song that was playing, did it feel like it was like a little bit more upbeat than what I was hoping for? It wasn't nearly as ominous.
Okay, so the soundtrack, I think, I mean, not to delve too far into it too early, but I like the soundtrack overall, and I am a person who's the soundtrack is going to either make or break a movie. But if I was going to put it on a scale of 1 to 10, I would probably give it a 6.
Yeah, it didn't seem to really like speak to me at all. I mean, even like towards the end, it seemed like it was just music that was there to fill a need. From what I was seeing, it wasn't something that really like stirred any kind of an emotional reaction.
Are you talking about the overall scope of the soundtrack for the entire movie, or do you mean just for this one specific scene?
I would have to go ahead and say overall. Yeah.
Because the Fleetwood Mac got me.
Okay.
I mean, we'll get there, but that got me. I was like, pretty good. He's welcomed into the home. He's introduced to Howard Howell. And he's offered a cup of tea, but he has just finished his Slurpee cup. It had a special name on it.
Chug-a-lug.
Oh, yeah, but it was spelled all terrible. It was like chug-e-lug. Like,
chug-e-lug?
Chug-e-lug. Like, it was trying to be a little bit more Canadian, but, like, they probably wouldn't be like, diabetes buster 64-ounce American,
right?
Because they're classy. But but he holds up his cup, which becomes, like we were talking about earlier, like a plot point to the entire film.
Mm-hmm.
And he like shakes it, the ice, like who does that? Like, I'd love to have your cup of tea, sir. Chicka, chicka, chicka. But first, I gotta drain the lizard. And I shite you not, it is like 7 minutes into the film. Sorry, still page one of my notes. And it's PC number two.
Mm-hmm. No. Here's the thing about the potty breaks. They mean something. Like, there's, like, the second one is the one that is the more subtler one. The first one, you know, he gets the hand, what is it? Hand scroll?
And hand script.
Hand script. The third one is, we'll get to that we'll get to that later. Spoilers for the entire movie, by the way. Don't know if anybody realized
that. Look, it doesn't have to be in order. It doesn't have to be accurate. What it has to be is slightly littered with profanities, motherfucker.
Only slightly.
Gotta keep it nice.
But, okay, so the third one, then, is when they realize that something has gone wrong with Wallace. And that's when they get the voicemail messages.
It's kind of like the P's are the entrances of the acts.
Right. But the second one, he's taken a pee, and he's looking down at this cover for a toilet paper roll, I'm assuming?
The old-fashioned, crocheted, weird Barbie doll toilet paper cover we all remember from the 80s.
Yeah. Now, this would have been a tip-off to most, well, probably not to most people. I've cleaned plenty of toilets with creepy things in it. But he just turns it around.
Pat, this is a throwback to an experience Kevin Smith had as a Ute.
What is a Ute?
It's what I call youths when I'm not being accurate with my words.
No, that's okay. Ute.
Just one of them Utes.
I thought maybe it was a job he had.
No, it was just him as a child, terrified of macrame. Mm-hmm. Through these first few scenes, there's also, I noticed, and I tend to look for the artistic leanings of certain set dressings. There are a couple masks that I find very fascinating. Once when Wallace is first speaking, before he goes to the bathroom, he's first speaking and joking to Howard, and there's a laughing mask behind him. I mean, former theater geek, I'm always looking for masks, holler. Mm-hmm. And so there's this laughing mask where he's presenting himself as a super jovial guy, right?
Right.
Cut to him in the bathroom where he just needs to take a leak and he's like kind of freaked out and he's unguarded and he moves the thing around. There's a mask behind him of this plain-faced, kind of mustachioed mask that I thought was very interesting. This is the thing about Wallace. This is why I think he's more of a douchebag than when he's acting like a douchebag, is because he is different in front of every person that he talks to. We'll find as we go on, like, him on the radio is a different mm-hmm. guy than him as a stand-up guy. Is different than when he's with his girlfriend. It's definitely different than when he's trying to get a story out of Howard. And it's not so much that he's, like, a chameleon. He's just he's always got this objective in mind. Like, is he gonna get some ass? Is he gonna get this popular podcast? Is he gonna get this information out of this guy? Like, he's always playing a part. And what is it gonna take for this guy to be genuine? Because he has not been genuine ever. He's never been genuine since he was a nerd on the stage. Okay, sorry. That's page one.
No, that's actually a really good point. See, again, my notes, they talk about a vampire bust that was in the room where their podcast is that made it, that looked to me a little bit like Lou Diamond Phillips. So these are my notes.
I didn't even notice any kind of...
Okay. I know, it was the weirdest thing. These are the notes. These are the things that I recognize.
You need to throw it out there because I will talk about me thinking I understand a plot.
Yeah, but your notes are a little bit more sophisticated. Mine's like the fact that I wrote in my notes, Walrus Cock, the podcast alt name.
I like that. Okay, so dude is taking a leak. He's come back to the parlor. And things are going to pick up really fast after this, but like there are certain points within the story that kind of drag on. And this is one of the times when it drags on when it's kind of great. Like, not kind of great. It is great. It's less great later on, maybe during the hamburger sliders scene when it could have picked up. I mean,
yeah.
I have this thing where I think, how long would I have devoted myself to this movie? This movie is about 140 minutes long. I could have seen this movie getting done in probably about 130 minutes, but there were some homages and some, like, some ball-licking to actors who, like... you know what? You're funny. Let's go with it. And the jokes didn't land as well as I think that they thought they did. Or, yeah. Or maybe I don't smoke enough weed to be able to appreciate that humor being drolled out the way it was. This scene, however, I think, I mean, I've seen it three times now. I think it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Like the way that Michael Parks delivers his lines, the way that they're received by
Justin Long.
Justin Long's character. They banter so well, and you can tell that it's this fantastic dialogue that Kevin Smith has written. And so he's now leading him into telling the stories. He tells this fantastic story about Hemingway, which I don't have time or interest to research Hemingway enough to be able to exposit on. But then, okay, so they go from this Hemingway, Howard Howell connection about this bottle of bourbon, was it bourbon? Some brown liquor that I wouldn't drink. But then, like, right next to it, in this beautiful jump of exposition, he's like, and what's this thing next to this bottle we're talking about? And Howard Howell is like,
it's a walrus cock.
But at my estimation, probably, like, I mean, I don't know how much walrus dicking or perhaps walrus wienering, for alliteration's sake, you would want in your typical movie. But Michael Parks does a pretty fantastic job talking for at least a minute.
Mm-hmm.
About walrus.
Well, and here's the thing. Where did it come from? Did it come from the walrus that was his friend?
Which we haven't even gotten to?
Right. Because what kind of a conversation is that?
He uses it as a weapon several times after this moment. And so I'm thinking he has, and let me not be too across, but he has an intimate relationship with this walrus. It's a phallic bone, and I didn't write down exactly what he said, because every time I've watched that scene, I've been like, huh.
Justin Long,
like, can't wait to get his hands on this thing.
I know, he has his hands, like, right near it, like, can I touch it?
and Michael Parks is like, yes, please do. Please do touch my walrus dong.
Which is hilarious when you think about, like, how much Wallace is so fascinated with being this character that he's not just, you know, putting out there for Howard, but also for his girlfriend, for his best friend. He's kind of portraying this character. Wallace is betraying this character that is sort of like in a lot of media, you see some of the male characters who are the leads. They got these quick whips. They're, you know, they're witty. They're a little bit charismatic. And that's kind of become a staple in the way that men are portrayed in some movies. But with him, it's like, if you had this on your wall, how many teenagers would be interested in, like, actually holding that as soon as they heard it was a walrus?
Well, I think that this shows an interesting leap in his character, because he goes from genuinely interested in this sort of dull story about Hemingway, which is intensely interesting in terms of the details and the complexity of Howard's character. But then he sees the grub for fame in, look at this dong, because his the people who listen to his podcast are obviously more interested in some sort of body humor that they can literally grab onto. I mean, the second he touches the bottle with this kind of awe and respect, but then he touches this phallus, which isn't really a phallus, and they go into great detail, but I didn't write it down because it wasn't very interesting at the time, except for the fact that it continued the plot. He picks up this thing and he immediately starts pretending to jack with it, and you can kind of see, whereas Howard originally had this banter with him, even though he'd already drugged him at this point. He had this witty banter with him before. When he sees him being like, oh, you're that guy, you can kind of see that facade crack for just half a second.
And this is why I enjoy Michael Parks in this character so much.
By the time we get to the dinner scene, I am absolutely sold on Michael.
I know. He's just such a wonderful actor. He's been in a couple of Tarantino films. He was in both Kill Bills, I believe. When going into his filmography. I don't remember. He was in the second one. He was the guy that the bride goes to that has the prostitute with, like, the cut lip or the cut mouth. But I don't remember who he was in the first one. So what happens after
After the Walrus Dong.
After the Walrus Dong.
Well, that leads into Michael Parks talking about, Howard Howell talking about his stranding from a shipwreck where he ends up, everybody else dies. He ends up on an iceberg or a
rock.
Yeah, like an island, whatever, with a walrus who's taking him into his blubbery, like a chick. Like, if you're really obsessed with walrus, you call him a pup. But I took a class. So, So he talks about how he was nursemaided by this walrus, and he leaves out a very important part that we'll talk about later, but he spends 6 months at the side of this walrus, and he uses one of my first written down quotes, God's most noble creature, and nice. Names him after a Mr. Tuskegee, custodian from his orphanage days.
Right. Which, I mean, you go into, there was, like, like when you do a quick search, it has nothing to do with anything else that the word Tuskegee is connected to outside of the fact that there's the word Tusk in it.
Yeah. Like you can just name your walrus friend Mr. Tusk. You don't have to have a Mr. Tuskegee who BT dubs. And I looked. Isn't brought up again. You could just call him Mr. Tusk.
Yeah.
And I would like to note right this second that he said that he was with him 6 months. Because I'm going to rant about that later on. 6 months.
Okay.
So when he gets to this part about Mr. Tusk, that's when the drugs that he's been given kick in and Wallace goes down. Cut to
him getting a blow from his girlfriend. And at this point, when we're watching it, Naomi has, like, I have thoughts about this. So if you just want to, I will say, what is it? The only thing that I pointed out is, did she stop giving him the blowjob to get him to take her to Canada?
She stopped mid-blow.
Right.
I mean, blowjob etiquette. Dear God, maybe I won't ask my dad to listen to this podcast. I just want to say that, like, you don't go in there. I mean, by all means, whenever you decide that you do not want to be doing that, you're out. You got full permission to exit that situation. You just pull the parachute cord and you are out. You don't have to give explanation. You are self-possessive of your own self. You are in possession of your whole person. Mm-hmm. You leave when you want to leave, right?
Right.
But she's, like, mid-blow, like, I think I'm going to give you a moral speech.
Right. It's not like she does not want to give this job because she doesn't find him attractive. She doesn't, or because she feels like he might be imposing certain, you know, like there's like certain things that are being imposed upon her that she doesn't want. She stops because she's trying to get something out of him.
She's got a moral platitude. She wants to shove up his ass, and that's not about that kind of foreplay.
She wants to get something out of him. Other than ejaculation.
Oh, God. Oh, man. I listened to way too much of My Favorite Murder, but I want to be like, edit that out. No, but it's perfectly acceptable. She stops in order to tell him that he should take her with him, and he's like, this is actually one of the first things that he's crass, he's rude, he's mean, but the second, like, the person he's supposed to be most intimate with, the second he was like, ah, oh, nah, I can't take your feelings into consideration, even though you're my closest compatriot, my counselor, my bestie lover, like, I'm going to disregard your feelings because I got to get this other thing done. And I'm like, no. And I know I kind of put romantic relationships on a pedestal, but when it's your significant other, that's your closest person. And when that person's upset about something, even though I disagree with when she brought it up, like, not my job.
Right.
But he was immediately dismissive. He's like, oh, come on. I can't bring you with me, even though it's totally plausible in the plot and for all other reasons. It's because you make me less funny. Teddy says you make me less funny. And she's like, well, and then she brings up old Wallace, new Wallace, which becomes this whole freaking thing we have to deal with for, like, seemingly the rest of the film. You're dealing with him pre-fame, post-fame, and it feels stale. Does that make sense? Like, maybe I'm too evolved, and I just think that people are ever-evolving creatures, and you don't have to analyze every moment.
Are you saying that the fact that they were kind of playing old Wallace and new Wallace? Because, I mean, he kind of goes through changes. Mm-hmm. He goes through changes before we see him at the in the film. He was an older person, and now he's a newer person, the new person that we've, you know. He was an old person before we see him in the movie. He's a new person, the one that we're seeing at the beginning of the movie. And then he changes. it almost seems like he goes through like, he goes through this traumatic event. We're getting up to it. Mm-hmm. And the reaction is so, so real. I mean, when you're talking about like him actually like being genuine, it is one of the more moments where Wallace as a character, not talking about Justin Long acting, because again, I think he does a really good job throughout the entire
movie.
Absolutely
agree with that.
But it's more Wallace being genuine, and he has some genuine moments, but we don't really, but the moment with Allie in this instance, that doesn't seem like he's being genuine. Like he's trying to
he
like,
immediately throws up a wall. And yeah. We learn later that it's because he wants to get Roadhead from some plump groupies who listen to, oh, and we haven't said this yet, the Nazi Party.
Oh yeah, so their podcast is called the Nazi Party.
Oh, should we spell it? Because they spell it a lot.
Yeah, it's N-O-T
dash
S-E-E. Like, okay.
I mean, like, it's just a joke that hits you over the head pretty hard a couple times, and it's like, yeah, I get it. And Lord help me that our podcast name is kind of punny.
Yeah. But it's not like referencing a group of fascists that, you know, happened within 100 years.
Yeah, well, it's I suppose it's supposed to reference the fact that they have to step over these social barriers, these tropes that, I mean, not tropes, but we have to step over these social boundaries that we've set up because some material is too sensitive. And he continuously steps over those things. And this is again what he's doing with his girlfriend. Oh my gosh. Like, you have his dick in your mouth. Why are you stopping to be like, moral predication? And I just can't see why you, and she was with him at the beginning. She's with him now. And I mean, why is she so up in arms when she's been carrying on like it's no big deal until this very moment? Like, what kind of revelation did she have with his dick in her mouth?
Well, yeah, it seems to me a little it was premeditated. Like, she was like, I'm going to, like, when I see the scene, I think she stops because she's trying to get him to take her to Canada. And she thinks that this is going to be a moment where he's going to say yes because he wants to get finished. But instead, he doesn't say yes. He sticks to his guns and he's just like, no.
And throws Teddy under the bus.
Right.
Which we're going to see on my third page of notes if we ever get there.
Right. Again, this is a horror movie. These people have to be jackasses in order for us to not feel as bad. Though, I mean, I'd like to see a horror movie where there are good people who end up, you know, getting, you know, like bad stuff happens to good people all the time. How real of a horror movie would it be? Maybe not entertaining, but it would be a real horror movie if you saw someone who was a nice person get mutilated horribly.
I mean, it happened to Paris Hilton in House of Wax. Not really, she was terrible.
I mean, you're probably more of a horror expert to me. Again, I don't really like horror. I think I've probably watched like 10 horror films my entire life.
Okay. Okay, so what happened was he passed out and he blinked, waking up to this blowjob, and then she goes back to give him a blowjob because apparently fights like that don't end with not blowjobs. Mm. And then he goes back to blinking awake again, and he's in a chair. And this is when we find out that his leg has been harvested.
Will Wallace discover any other body parts missing? Will old men ever stop requesting young men to see their collection of megafauna genitalia? Will Naomi stop saying BJ so much because editing is hard? Hey, this is your audio engineer and first-time listener, Jonathan, reminding you that things can end badly, especially in the hands of nerds. So why not go play part 2 of Naomi and Lydia's Gorging of Tusk? Now, that way, this is just the middle and not the end. And frankly, it makes goodbyes a bit easier on my anxiety. Until then, please remember to spay and neuter your applause before releasing them into the wild. We'll have social links and shareable content for your part as a listener soon. From the few of us at Shocked and Applaud, thank you for patroning the peculiar.